I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our new podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. We're both journalists who moonlight as poker players, and that's the lens we're going to use to approach this entire show.
We're going to be discussing everything from high-stakes poker to personal questions.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
And of course, we'll be talking about the election, too.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What happened in the Supreme Court today? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Joe Biden's weakness and what's happening right now on the world stage. We have an update on the border, all that and more coming up on I'm Right. World War II. You know about World War II? Don't worry, we're going to get to Weak Joe in a minute. World War II. Do you know Neville Chamberlain? You've probably heard the name. I know you've heard the name Adolf Hitler. You know one of the reasons Hitler chose to be so ambitious with his invasions and takeovers of Europe was he had a meeting with Neville Chamberlain where he sized the man up personally. And he decided this human being doesn't have what it takes. I'll be able to go take what I want and this weakling isn't going to do anything. The Cuban Missile Crisis, you know about that. We've talked about this before on the show. Why would the Soviet Union take the step of moving nuclear missiles to Cuba where they could hit Washington, D.C.? That's a big step. I mean, a big part of it was we had nuclear missiles in Turkey aimed at Russia. But still, what was the catalyst? What happened there? John F. Kennedy, very young, youngest president ever elected, had a meeting with Khrushchev. And later on, Kennedy, by his own admission, and Khrushchev obviously was very loud about this, Kennedy said, I looked weak and feeble and stupid. And Khrushchev walked out of that meeting and thought to himself, this guy's pathetic and weak. Let's move. These person-to-person interactions, the appearance of weakness is a really, really big deal. You do understand, speaking of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that a nuclear submarine, a Soviet submarine, I guess I should say it wasn't nuclear, but a Soviet submarine carrying nuclear-tipped torpedoes, the captain of the submarine at one point gave the order to fire those nuclear-tipped torpedoes, and his crew had to step in and overrule him. We were that close to full-blown nuclear war because of what? Because John F. Kennedy was too weak in appearance when he met with Khrushchev. Joe Biden, it is so much fun to make fun of him as, you know, Papa Joe, Poopy Pants Joe, and Dementia Joe, and he can't get it, he can't talk. It is fun. But you understand that this has the potential to end the world? That's not being over the top. This has the potential to end the world. When you look at what's happening out there right now, what the other powerful nuclear nations are doing right now. And we have a president of the United States of America who has to be saved from the media by his granddaughter?
Yes, one of the things that you may recall that I initiated was the international flat tax provision. We got 140-some nations to sign on to it. I'm coming. This is my son, Bo's oldest daughter, and she's trying to tell me, Dad, Grandpa, Pop, get going. You promised me you'd walk. Okay.
Excuse me? The leader of the free world chose to stop and answer questions, and granddaughter comes up and says, nope, no more questions. Now, you might not think that's a big deal. I promise you, Vladimir Putin thinks that's a big deal. Xi Jinping thinks that's a really, really big deal. And this is something that I've tried to explain 1,000 times. If I have a bad night here on TV, right here on I'm Right on the First, let's say maybe I got the flu, or tired, didn't sleep, whatever the case may be, and I'm coming off kind of weak and feeble, I'm slumped over, it doesn't matter. I'll be back tomorrow, do it again. The world's not going to change if I have a bad night on television. If Joe Biden has bad day after bad day after bad day after bad day in front of television cameras, it has the ability to change and or end the world. Do you remember when Afghanistan collapsed, right? Afghanistan collapsed, and this was a moment, very few moments like this, actually, but this was a moment when the whole world was focused on us. They're always watching us, but they were focused on us. What, America's pulling out? Afghanistan, this is embarrassing. People are getting killed. What's going on? And Joe Biden gets up to speak about it. Do you have any idea how many people in how many countries across the world watch the President of the United States of America speak like this?
Thank you. May God bless you all, and may God protect his troops and all those standing watch for America. We have so much to do. It's within our capacity to do it. We just have to remain steadfast. Steadfast. Ladies and gentlemen, they gave me a list here. The first person I was instructed to call on was Kelly O'Donnell of NBC.
The first person I was instructed to call on? They've been watching the whole time. And you remember what I said back then? This whole thing is not only amateurish and embarrassing, this whole thing is amateurish and embarrassing in front of the whole world. It's one thing if you walk outside and slip on the ice and fall on your rear end and you're by yourself. It's quite another if you're at a party with 500 people watching. We just embarrassed ourselves with the entire world watching. They think we're weak. They think we're amateurish. Our allies aren't quite sure if we're going to be there for them. And how could they be sure of that? We've got our allies in Afghanistan dropping like flies. This is a disaster. The world is looking right now, and they're asking, are they still top dog? I mean, this is not what the top dog does. This is what some fading power does. And it's true. And guess what we learned today? I can't even. Iran now has enough material to build a nuclear weapon. And I need to lay something out for you here just so everyone's clear on this. Let's set China aside for a moment. Iran and Russia, they're like this. Iran, they're now not only apparently a nuclear power, they have voiced publicly several times their intention to eliminate Israel from the map. Israel, they're not a nation that can allow that, obviously. They can't give Iran a chance. Let's have peace talks. If Iran is truly ready, if Israel believes Iran is truly ready to launch a weapon at them, Israel's going to declare war, and Israel's going to attack first. Israel attacks Iran. Russia's right there as an ally of Iran. We're an ally of Israel. Are you starting to get a picture of just how dangerous things are right now on the world stage? We are standing on a knife's edge. On a knife's edge. China's busy saber-rattling all the time right now with Taiwan. They're doing it again and again and again. They violated Taiwan's airspace 1,400 times. Okay, so we have the Iran-Russia-Israel dynamic. Now let's go over to the Chinese dynamic. We're way beyond saber-rattling at this point in time. At this point in time, they're sharpening the saber right in front of you and staring at you like they want to cut your throat. Oh, and by the way, did I mention President Dementia committed us to full-blown war if China attacks?
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's the commitment we made.
That's the commitment we made. Are you starting to appreciate more and more just how dangerous it is to have a president of the United States of America who's not even a fully functional adult? In fact, he's a feeble old man. And look, let's just fast forward a little bit here. What would happen in one of these wars? I mean, wars don't look like the last war, right? But one thing we do know, this is simply a fact, A huge part of wars since World War II is air power. Wars are fought in the air. Navies are important, much as that pains me to say. Air forces are important, much as that pains me to say. We have a report out today that the Navy and Air Force are struggling to keep planes ready for takeoff. Struggling to keep planes ready for takeoff. We have a Navy and Air Force. We have a Navy that's crashing into underwater mountains. We have an Air Force whose planes aren't ready to take off the ground. We have Iran threatening nuclear war, now obtaining a nuclear weapon. Russia invading Ukraine, us helping the people Russia is fighting, and China wants to invade Taiwan. And the President of the United States of America can't get through two sentences without screwing up words and names and forgetting what planet he's on. And in case you're wondering what the Navy is doing to right these wrongs, get those planes ready, get those ships ready. Here's a little sample of the training that's going on in the United States Navy.
Hi, my name is Johnny, and I use he, him pronouns.
Hi, and I'm Conchi, and I use she, her pronouns.
And we're here to talk about pronouns.
What is a pronoun? A pronoun is how we identify ourselves apart from our name, and it's also how people refer to us in conversations.
Using the right pronouns is a really simple way to affirm someone's identity. It is a signal of acceptance and respect.
If it's a signal of acceptance and respect, how do we go about creating a safe space for everybody?
That's a good question. A really good way to do that is to use inclusive language. Instead of saying something like, hey guys, you can say, hey everyone, or hey team. Some names are very difficult to pronounce, but do you know what is very easy to pronounce?
She, he, they.
We're gonna lose a major war. At West Point right now, we just got documents. The cadets, they're learning about whiteness and using critical race theory to analyze that. We're talking about millions of lives. We're talking about the potential end of the earth, and we elected the President of the United States of America who has dementia and has fully embraced this cultural Marxist filth. We are in deep trouble. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I'm right. And we're being invaded as we speak across our southern border. We'll talk to John Daniel Davidson about that in just a moment. Now, that was enough darkness. Let's talk about some light. Let's talk about you. What do you have for your health insurance? Do they have your values? I want you to go do me a favor right now. Just while I'm talking, I want you to pick up your phone. I know you have it in your hands. Don't lie. And I want you to do an internet search for the name of your health insurance company in Pride Month. And then I want you to think about you sending your health insurance money every single month to that company. Does that make you feel good? You know, OneShare Health, they're a faith-based company. They share your values. Great coverage, great options across the board. You name it, 24/7, telehealth, vision, dental, they have it all. And they share your values. Go to my.oneshareHealth.com/Kelly, and when you use the promo code Jesse Kelly, that gets you $75 off. We'll be back.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
Since Joe Biden took office, 1 million illegal immigrants have been released within the border of the United States of America. That is twice the population of Wyoming. John Daniel Davidson, he's a senior editor with the Federalist, great magazine. He just released a two-part series where he interviewed people on the border. You see, I've been down to the border. I ran for Congress twice down in a border district, so I spent a lot of time down there talking to these people. They told me stories about having to use the buddy system to go get the mail with weapons. So I want to talk to John, because unless you're down there, you don't know. John? First, illegal immigration, the black market. How does an illegal immigrant from Guatemala, let's just say, how do they pay the thousands of dollars it takes to have the coyotes haul them up into America? This person doesn't have a toy on the ground. They have thousands of dollars?
Most of them don't. And there's one of two ways that they do it. They either sell everything that they have, their home, if they have a small farm, any possessions they have, and sort of go all in with everything just to get up to the border. Or they go into debt from loan sharks back home. Or I guess there's a third way, they get part of the way there and run out of money, and then their family goes into debt to loan sharks back home. And these loan sharks are not, you know, it's not Easy Pawn or something like we have here. These are bad people. And so a lot of these folks are in debt for tens of thousands of dollars that they can't start paying off until they get into the United States and start working. That's the whole premise of their plan, is that they're going to be able to get in so they can pay off this debt. And until they do, a lot of times their families are in danger.
Good grief. Okay, what's a fix for something like that, John? And why would you risk that? I understand everyone wants to come to America, and I do get that it's really, really terrible in a lot of these Central American countries where most of these people are coming from now. But if I've got, you know, a wife and kids back home and some loan shark in El Salvador might chop their hands off, why even risk it?
Well, one reason you would risk it is if that a whole bunch of people that you knew and a whole bunch of family members had done the same thing and had gotten into America and were like sending you Facebook messages from their job where they were making 10 times what you were making now. And if you knew dozens or hundreds of people that had done that, you might think, now, it's a pretty good chance I'll get in too. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, Kamala Harris can go to Guatemala and shake her head and say, don't come, don't come. But who are you going to believe? Kamala Harris or like all your cousins and neighbors and friends from your hometown who got in and are sending money home? And that's the dynamic here. It doesn't matter what the administration says. It matters what their policies actually do. And what they actually do is allow people to get into the country and get released inside the United States.
John, the shelters, these migrant shelters, what's it like?
They're pretty horrible, I'm not going to lie. We went to shelters in Matamoros, which is across the river from Brownsville, Texas, and in Reynosa, which is across the river from McAllen, Texas. Very dangerous border towns, and the shelters are in bad parts of town, as you can imagine. They don't put migrant shelters in the nice parts of town. And a lot of the people who are staying there are Haitians, who are afraid to cross the border illegally because they don't want to be deported to Haiti. And the reason they don't want to be deported to Haiti is because they haven't lived there in years and years. Some of them are for a decade. They came to northern Mexico from South America, where most of them have been living for quite some time. They had legal status, so some of them had asylum status, some of them had citizenship in these countries in South America. But they heard that they could get into the United States and make even more money and have a better life, and so they came north. And the last thing they want after last fall, when all those Haitians in the Del Rio encampment were deported to Haiti, sort of word went out in the Haitian community, there's a risk if you get cross illegally and you'll get deported to Haiti. And so they're waiting for something to change. And so the majority of the migrants you see in these shelters are Haitians.
John, I'm just assuming, and maybe you know this, maybe you don't, I'm assuming the crime in these shelter areas has got to be absolutely rampant. I know refugee camps across the world historically are places where terrible things happen to women and children and theft and all kinds of other things. It has to be the same here, right?
Yeah, a lot of these migrant shelters are actually walled compounds with like high concrete walls and big steel doors. And a lot of the people inside, especially the women, they won't leave the shelter for any reason. It's too dangerous out there. Too many people have been kidnapped, have been assaulted, often sexually assaulted in the case of the women. And, you know, the cartels in these places, they run everything. And so they will stop migrants. They will stop buses that are coming into town full of migrants, and they will ask everybody for a code. And if you've paid the cartel off, you give them the code number and you're free to go. But if you haven't, well, then they pull you off the bus. They take you to a stash house. You get a hold of your family back home, and you don't leave there until you've paid. And we talk to families who are held for weeks in these stash houses waiting for the money to come through from their families back home.
God have mercy. All right, John, you were down there. How can we fix this? How do we stop this?
Stop letting people over the border. Stop releasing them into the United States. It's actually really, it's not as complicated as it sounds to fix this. And I'm not saying that would like end all illegal immigration. You're always going to have some illegal immigration when you have a 2,000-mile land border. You're always going to have people who can cross the border and evade law enforcement and sort of sneak in or smuggle drugs in. But what's happening here can be stopped simply by not releasing people into the United States. If that message never gets back to the sending country, if these people never hear from their cousins or their neighbors or their family members who went north to get into the United States, and instead those people end up showing up back home because they got deported, well, that dries up the demand for this sort of thing really fast. People are not inclined to sort of bet the farm, so to speak, and or go into debt with loan sharks if they don't think there's a good chance that they can get in. And that's actually what we saw under Trump. We saw illegal immigration decline down to historic lows, partly because people were not getting in, and the word gets around fast.
John Daniel Davidson, go read all his stuff at The Federalist. Thank you, man. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Jesse.
All right. The Uvalde school shooting, my word, it somehow gets worse the further away from it we get. We'll talk about that in a moment with Sarah Gonzalez. Before we talk about that, let's talk about everybody complaining about their allergies right now. I had them for years. I'm not judging if you're complaining about them. They're freaking miserable. Why are you still suffering? I've told you about Eden Pure Thunderstorm a million times. And I know you think it's an air purifier, so you're picturing this big tower that makes a bunch of noise. There's just this little black box. It goes right in the outlet. It doesn't hardly make any noise. You won't know what's there. It cleans your air so well, you can smell it and taste it when you walk out of the house and come back in. My allergies are gone. I don't have them anymore. I haven't for a long time. I own three of these things. I started out with one, went and got two more. Go to EdenPureDeals.com, use the code Jesse, and that gets you a three-pack for under $200. EdenPureDeals.com, code Jesse. We'll be back.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last two decades since the Columbine massacre. 3 minutes after the subject entered the West Building, there was a sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to isolate, distract, and neutralize the subject. The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children. The officers had weapons. The children had none. The officers had body armor. The children had none.
Joining me now, Sarah Gonzalez, of course, as you know, host of The News and Why It Matters on Blaze TV. Sarah, I do the best I can not to judge people who are in life-threatening situations when I wasn't there, right? I do the best I can with that. I have been wrestling with this since I saw that this morning and did the read up on it. As a man, forget cop, as a man, you're standing in the hall with a weapon while 10-year-olds are being executed and you don't do anything? Sarah, explain this to me.
Jesse, I can't. It makes me sick to my stomach and infuriated, and not just as a mother, but also as a supporter of law enforcement to hear that it was not just the commanding officer. 11 officers were there on the scene inside the school within 3 minutes of the shooter entering, and still they waited for over an hour didn't even check the doors to see if the doors were actually locked. We've been lied to this entire time from an agency that I think it's safe to say you and I have both supported in the past. And look, I'm not saying that I don't support police anymore, but what I'm saying is we have to take a long, hard look at policing as a general rule and figure out, how did we come this far? How did we see over the course of 2 years during COVID, we saw police officers arresting mothers in playgrounds. Now we're seeing these men standing around listening, presumably, to children being shot and doing nothing about it. It's absolutely infuriating. Something has to change. I don't know, Jesse, if I can blame the left's constant demoralization of police in general. Maybe all the good ones left. I can't tell you what has happened, but what I can tell you as you're speaking as a man, I'm speaking as a mother. You could not have stopped me. I would have been the mom who got detained and figured out how to get undetained and run into the school to save her children. And as an officer, I can tell you, I would have said, you know what? You're going to have to shoot me to stop me because I'm going in there and I'm saving children. And trust me, I love police as a general rule, but something is very, very wrong in policing. And we need to figure out what it is before more innocents die.
Something is wrong. Everything seems broken. And I'll be honest, Sarah, I'm not going to speculate on conspiracy theories or whatnot, but nothing about this makes sense. I mean, again, you can blame the on-site commander all you want. That's fine. I'm sure he's very guilty of everything they're accusing him of. That's fine. But the guys underneath him, how do you sit there and let the on-site commander stop you? I mean, look, I was in the Marines. If we had a platoon commander who said, no, you can't save the kids, well, sir, you could go screw yourself. I'm going, and go ahead and try to stop me. I don't know how you do it if you're those guys either.
That's what I'm saying, Jesse. I mean, it is completely unfathomable to me. And look, I've been listening to the hearings today. I understand that they said that, you know, maybe an officer tried to question, maybe tried to go through anyway and was detained, or the parents were detained. You mean to tell me you didn't have a handful of all of those grown men over there who said, yeah, you know what? Screw it. What are you going to do? Detain all of us? What are you going to do? Stop all of us? We're going in there and we're saving children. It is just, it's completely unfathomable. And then, of course, on top of all of that, you have the left using this as a reason to disarm the public when all this proves, this is like the greatest case you could ever make, that Americans need to be making sure that they are armed with the same exact weapons that law enforcement has and the criminals have. Because when everything else, you know, when all of this happens, you cannot trust law enforcement to always be there to protect you. And yet we're having the conversation about disarming the public. It's absolutely maddening. How did we get into this position?
I have no idea. It's insane. And it's insane. Look, to switch gears here, what's happening in the cities is just as insane. And I'm telling people right now to get out of these cities. Milwaukee has 25% increase in crime. D.C., Atlanta, 13. Los Angeles, 7. Baltimore's way up, of course. City after city after city across the United States of America. They've turned into basically Mexican border towns, Sarah, with all due respect to you. I don't know how this happened. How did these cities get so lawless?
You know, it's interesting. I think maybe we can tie this back to what we were just talking about in policing, because as I mentioned, perhaps we don't have any good police anymore because policing has just been totally demonized as a whole by the left. And you've seen a lot of good officers leave. You've seen cities be run by Democrats, and, you know, the Democrats in charge will then give directives to, oh, I don't know, allow people to burn entire cities down. So I think that when criminals generally see that people are charges are being dropped against people who literally were burning businesses to the ground for no good reason other than their hurt feelings. Criminals are seeing this. Criminals are seeing all of this lawlessness, and they're seeing typically the Democrats in charge of these cities just constantly overlook it. Wouldn't you be emboldened and empowered if you were a criminal? I mean, wouldn't you say, there's no one here to stop me. I guess I'm just going to kind of do my thing.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about, as much as this pains me, let's stop talking about that and start talking about you for a minute, Sarah. You had a run-in with the Beto staffer. In fact, we have a little video here.
You can't take a video.
And my question was...
Oh, sorry, we're not recording. No, sorry.
Don't touch my phone.
Excuse me. What's your badge number? Why did you just push me down the...
You gotta get out.
That's fine, but why did she just put her hands on me so hard?
She asked you to leave and you're not leaving.
No, she didn't. She didn't ask me to leave at all. She pushed me down the stairs.
I'm telling you to leave.
What is your badge number? Hey, I appreciate you being respectful and not putting your hands on me. Thank you.
Sarah? What was up with the first guy there, and what's going on with all this? What am I looking at?
Well, what you just saw was me at a public event, a very public event, where everyone had their phones out and were taking pictures and videos, and I was silently, very quietly, recording an interaction between another constituent and Mr. Robert Francis O'Rourke. This constituent, of course, gave me permission to record, in fact, asked me to record the interaction because he wanted to ask a question about the World Economic Forum. I thought, that's a pretty relevant question. Let's get it on film. Let's get this guy who's running for the head of Texas, let's get his answer on film. What I was met with was a staffer who was very aggressive, who immediately tried to make sure that I didn't catch that answer, grabbed my phone, tried to pry it out of my hands, which is when you hear me say, don't touch my phone. As I'm trying to maintain control over my own personal property, the officer comes in, pins my arms, and pushes me on my way over to the stairs. So we are actually, we filed a federal lawsuit against all of the parties for assault and for violating my civil rights, because as you saw right there, quietly standing there, law-abiding citizen, filming, and I got assaulted for it. And you know what? The abuse of power is too much, and I know the average citizen doesn't have the resources to stand up and fight back, and so I felt like I needed to do that.
Shoot, yeah. Go get them, Sarah. Sarah Gonzalez, The News and Why It Matters is her show. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right. We didn't get a ruling on abortion today, but we did get another big one. We're going to talk to our legal expert, Will Chamberlain, about that next. But first, I want to talk to you about security. I know you're interested in weapons, food, water, all these things. A huge part of a military is secure communications. A huge part of law enforcement, secure communications. It has to become a huge part of your life as well. You do not have secure communications. You just don't. These gigantic companies that give you and me all these free email addresses, they're reading your emails. They'll admit it to you. This is public knowledge. They're reading the emails you get, and they're reading the emails you send. And they're selling it. They're selling your data. You've got to switch to secure so you have a secure way to communicate by email. You have to. It's based in Switzerland. If you use the promo code Jesse, 25% off, that gets you $7.50 a month for a price to have totally secure email. They can't get to them because they're in Switzerland. Secure.com, promo code Jesse. We'll be back. There's a lot of Supreme Court news today. I'm not a lawyer, I'm an idiot. So we need to bring in someone who knows this stuff. So of course, friend of the show, Will Chamberlain joins me now. He's the senior counsel at the Internet Accountability Project. Will, before we get to everything that did happen today, let's talk about something that didn't. This whole Roe versus Wade decision, everyone's waiting. Why don't we have one of these yet? How's this work?
Well, I mean, the court wants to release its decisions ideally by the end of June, but they set their own schedule. They're the Supreme Court. They're an independent branch of government. So they want to have it done. Usually it's done by end of June. Sometimes it reaches into just the first few days of July. But what it means is that it's probably going to be one of the last opinions they release. And I guess to some degree that makes sense. You know, after all the opinions are done, they usually go out of town, travel to Europe, give speeches around the country, around the world. And so maybe they're looking to be out of town when all the furor is erupting around their decision.
Well, I know this is a really dumb question, but you and I have known each other for a while. You're not going to be surprised by that. Why not just come up with a list and hand it out in one day and then go off to France or wherever you go? Why do we have to do this thing where one day today and then another one Thursday? I don't understand. What's the point?
Well, there's a whole process of writing and developing all these opinions, and they really want to make sure they're exactly right, because a Supreme Court opinion is essentially binding law for what, as long as it's a live decision, could be, 100 years, could be more. And so that, and the law is the writing, and it's being done by these nine justices, and each of them only has four clerks. So it's not exactly a massive staff, and much smaller than, for example, Congress has, or and much, much smaller than the executive branch. So it's not surprising that they're really work on refining the text. And so for any in one of these individual opinions, they don't want to release it until they have a polished opinion that everybody agrees to. And it's not like they just want to randomly announce what the result is before they have the opinion alongside it. They want to, you know, they want to, when they announce the decision, they want to offer the reasoning to them.
Okay. Okay. Well, good. That leads me perfectly into the Alito leaked opinion. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Okay. So that wasn't official yet. What was that, like a rough draft? And then they have to decide, do they agree? Do we just have to cross another T and dot an I? What do we know?
That was a draft opinion, and it's not necessarily, we don't know, have no idea what stage of the draft that was. That could have been a very, very early draft that nobody else, no other justice had agreed to. That could be a later version of the draft that some justices had agreed to and some justices hadn't. But what it was, I mean, and one of the reasons that's so damaging to the court is that they don't want to release half-published opinions, again, because, you know, this is the law. It can affect not just this decision, but every other future Supreme Court decision, because future Supreme Court decisions cite previous decisions as precedent. So they want to get it right, and they don't want to release half-published things, and it means that as a result, like, normally there's this open line of communication between the justices and their clerks, but now, like, you should expect things to get a lot different. And the Supreme Court probably were working a lot different way. I mean, they still have yet to identify the leaker or inflict any punishment for that.
What do you mean work in a different way? What way did it work before, and how's that going to change?
Well, it was much more, it's been much more trust-based, right? So, you know, you have these nine justices, and they each hire four clerks that serve for a year. And the way that these opinions are developed is that the justices and their clerks, or, you know, one justice is assigned an opinion after they have like an early preliminary vote, and that justice writes a draft opinion with the assistance of their clerks, and then that opinion is circulated, and other justices will join that opinion or ask for revisions to be made so that it reflects, you know, something they agree with. And that, you know, there's a back and forth editorial and process with this negotiation that goes on. And it's done pretty openly and candidly. And also, you know, the justices work openly with their clerks to get this done, because, you know, there's a lot of writing that has to be done. If the justices have to do it all on their own, you would have far fewer cases being taken and the process would take much longer. But that said, you know, this relies on confidentiality in chambers between a judge and the people working for them, that those people won't just leak things on them and leak draft opinions before they're ready to be released. Given the fact that we finally did have this leak, the Supreme Court's going to either have to put in increased security measures or vet it, you know, background checks that, you know, make this impossible, or maybe formalize punishments, do a lot more active surveillance of the clerks and the justices, which they never had to do before, because they were able to rely on the fact that these clerks had worked extraordinarily hard to get to be a Supreme Court clerk. Remember, it's in a very prestigious position that takes a lot of time, and only, you know, only 36 law students a year get to do it out of 10,000 or something. And that, you know, as a result, they wouldn't do anything to jeopardize their career.
Is it going to jeopardize their career, though, Will? I mean, let's say they come out and it's some pink-haired freak who clerks for Sotomayor or somebody like that. How hard are they even going to be hit? You and I both know they're going to have a book deal, a cable news deal, and everything else in about 15 minutes. It doesn't jeopardize squat, right?
Well, it's going to narrow their options, right? Let's put it that way. Because, I mean, and that's not saying a huge amount, because Supreme Court justices have every option in the world. So, I mean, or Supreme Court clerks, rather. So oftentimes, former Supreme Court clerks go and work at the Department of Justice or another high-level government agency as like a top-level lawyer there. That's pretty common. That's going to be closed off. There's no way they would be able to do that, because the judges wouldn't listen to them, and it would just be very, very bad reputationally. Similarly, they probably couldn't get a job as like a high-impact litigator. Like if their job was actually to go in front of judges every day, judges would remember and be very angry, and so their reputation and their ability to actually practice law like a normal lawyer is probably gone. That said, you're right. I think they'll probably get a professorship at Yale or in a TV talking head spot without much of a problem.
Okay. Will, we still have communist street animals protesting in front of the homes of conservative justices. As everyone has said 1,000 times, that's illegal. That's not allowed.
Yes.
why won't Virginia do something? Of course, the FBI is not going to do anything. They're probably in the crowd. But why can't Virginia do something?
I'm not sure. I think Virginia could do something. I think there's some statutes on their books about protesting at night at private residences, but they don't have a specific statute that relates to, obstruction of justice, which is the kind of thing that this, the federal code has more to do, federal statute has something to do with obstruction of justice. Like, you're not allowed to protest, not just at a judge's home, but like at a police officer's home or something with the intent of influencing how they use public office. And it's, so I'm not sure, I don't know exactly what the state of Virginia should do, but all, I mean, my view is they should try and find a way, right? I think Glenn Youngkin has been too happy to sort of kick the can over to the feds and say, well, the feds aren't doing anything, so I can't. Like, no, it'd be actually a great spot for him to, you know, look a little bit more like DeSantis and find a way to use the authority that he has to put an end to these unlawful protests.
Finally, Will, Carson versus Macon. That's the decision we got today. I don't know what any of those words mean. I don't know Carson or Macon. What is this whole thing?
Well, to be fair, I don't really know who Carson and Macon are either. But I know what the case was about. The case was about whether Maine had a program for kids who lived in rural areas where there wasn't like a high school that said that the Maine government would subsidize their tuition at any public or private school as long as the private school was non-sectarian, right, non-religious. And the Supreme Court said, no, if it's a generally available benefit available to the public, then you can't just randomly, you just can't choose to exclude religious schools. That's a violation of the First Amendment. I think that, you know, this is definitely a positive thing for charter schools and especially charter school programs that want to provide access to religious schools, essentially saying that, you know, if you have some sort of charter school program that allows people to channel their public school dollars to, or their education tax money to a private school, the state has to allow that money to be spent on tuition at a religious school. Otherwise, that's a violation of the First Amendment. So I think it's a positive ruling. It's not a dramatic change in the way the law works. There already were a number of cases that had established this principle pretty clearly. And so this isn't some dramatic reversal of the law, but it's still a good decision to see.
Will, final question here. I've had a lot today because I want to know what all this stuff is. Setting the Roe versus Wade, the Dobbs one aside, yeah. Is there anything else we should be paying attention to? That's the only one anyone's talking about, but I'm sure there's something important in there that we're not paying attention to.
I'm pretty sure there's an important Second Amendment rights case, but I honestly just haven't read up enough on it to have an idea of what I should tell you. Dobbs is definitely the big one. I mean, we're still looking most likely at the reversal of Roe v. Wade, and that's still the most likely outcome here, which is a dramatic, dramatic outcome.
Will Chamberlain, thank you so much, my man.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right. It is time for Lighten the Mood next. But before we lighten the mood, let's talk about sickness. You know, you ever watch any Civil War documentaries or read any Civil War books about there? They're fascinating. Horrific conflict. And when you think about Civil War, you think about 600,000 Americans dying of bayonets and bullets and cannons, and it's horrible. But that's not where most of them died. Most of them died in the hospitals. Most of them died of infection, sickness. When you think about the preparations you've made for things potentially going bad, I know you buy water. I hope you buy water. I know you have ammo, food. What do you have for medication? And I don't just mean your regular day-to-day medication. I hope you've been smart enough to stock that up. What do you have for antibiotics? That little infection you get is deadly when the hospital isn't there anymore or it's shut down. Buy a Jace case. In fact, buy a couple of them. Jace Medical has this thing, a Jace case, and it's essentially a flight of antibiotics. I don't want you to ever have to use it. I pray to God you don't, but man alive, if you end up needing it, if your son's sitting there with a cut on his leg and it's bad and it's starting to smell, boy, are you going to be grateful you have antibiotics to give him. Go to jacemedical.com and get a couple Jace cases today. Use the promo code Jesse, gets you $10 off. jacemedical.com. We'll be back. Summertime, that means it's pool time. which means it's time for us to all get back in the gym. And I don't know about you, but I totally support this guy's routine.
When I said I go to gym,
I'll see you tomorrow.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
I'm Maria Konnikova.
And I'm Nate Silver.
And our new podcast, Risky Business, is a show about making better decisions. We're both journalists who moonlight as poker players, and that's the lens we're going to use to approach this entire show.
We're going to be discussing everything from high-stakes poker to personal questions.
Like whether I should call a plumber or fix my shower myself.
And of course, we'll be talking about the election, too.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.